Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's Henrik here. Before we start the recording, I just wanted to let you know that around the 1 hour mark or so with Greg, we are going to discuss the drama with TRS and Mikey Enoch in particular. And I just wanted to let you know that I've not looked fully into the situation, so I can't honestly make an intelligent assessment at this point of what is going on. We're keeping busy with the inauguration coverage today, this Friday, gathering footage, doing a report for you on Weekend Warrior. So, you know, we're busy with that. Anyway, so what you'll hear in the show is Greg's opinion about this, and we want to give you a chance to hear a side in clear defense of Mike Enoch. Not sure what to make of all the accusations and rumors, to be honest, at this point. When we recorded this show, there wasn't any shows out with Mike yet, any interviews with him. I believe there are a few now at the time of this recording, but I haven't had the time to listen to those or hear firsthand what he has to say about all of this. So I'll just remain diplomatic for now and say that I've met Mike twice. He was very nice to us, and I like the work that he's been doing. I wish that less fracturing episodes were taking place within the alt-right, and that these wedge issues that our enemies can drive into our movement would not come so easily to them. So it's a difficult situation. But anyway, there'll be more I can say about this at a later point. Maybe we can talk with Mike, too, at some point. And ask him what the hell is going on with everything. So that's what I have to say about that for now. So we'll switch over to our interview with Greg Johnson. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. It's good to have you here. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice Radio. The website is redice.tv. And do make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel to get the latest shows and the videos and the live shows right to you as soon as they are out. Well, we're here with Greg Johnson today from Counter Currents. We spoke about doing a show with Greg, I think, a couple of weeks ago. And of course, a lot of things have actually unfolded since that time. So I think this is actually timely. We can take the opportunity, if you will, to actually discuss some things of what has been going on lately. So this will be good to churn some of that stuff out. But welcome back, Greg. Good to have you on the show again.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. I wanted to begin talking a little bit about actually millennial woes first. We've had these doxing, you know, dramas occurring here in the last couple of weeks, really. It's unfolded as we've entered into the new year. And get your take on what has happened to woes and some of the harassment by the mainstream media, what some of the appropriate responses and everything else should be to this. And I actually spoke with woes a little bit earlier today over Skype, over chat. We didn't actually get a chance to talk, but I was asking him whether or not he could confirm if there were some people involved, whatever. So for those who doesn't know, who have been living under a rock, you had the Daily Record in Scotland. The journalist, well, I guess I don't know, that's kind to call him a journalist, but the guy named Alan McEwen, who the slime that published all these details about woes, including a photo of the house with a clear number on it and all these kinds of things, really going after him in so many different ways. And when I spoke with woes, we speculated that possibly an old friend to woes, or maybe it was, someone who just actually had recognized him, that gave information to the Daily Record. And then they realized, well, we can't, you know, just publish this. Something could happen legally or whatever. So it looks like the paper or someone at the paper handed it off to this blog run by Liam Turbet. And there's still question marks about this. We don't know. Woz doesn't know either. So it's kind of speculation, but it looks like this is what happened. And then after that point, the paper, the Daily Record, could basically just say, oh, look at this. This blog here just posted this information. We'll just report on it as is. And then that's when the whole thing just started to kind of fall apart. But what do you know about the woe situation, Greg? And how do you view these kinds of things when they do occur?
Well, I was really disgusted and horrified by the doxing of millennial woes and a number of other friends of mine connected with the right stuff. The reason why the left doxes people is because it works, because we advocate ideas that are stigmatized, that can make us targets, and that's why we usually use pen names. That's why so many of us hide our identities, because it's dangerous to take the stances that we take, and there are real-world consequences in our jobs, in our families, even criminal harassment that will take place from these Antifa elements. So they do it because it works. And until it no longer works, they will continue to do it. Fortunately, millennial woes is able to do what he does from anywhere in the world. And so once his identity was revealed and his location was revealed, he was able to pack up and move somewhere else to an undisclosed location. He can live anywhere on the continent, because basically anywhere on the continent that's within the EU. And he might end up in the United States eventually. Who knows? But the fact of the matter is he's safe right now. He's a bit traumatized, but he's unwinding from this. And he's not going to give up on what he's been doing. There's just no way he's going to give up on what he's been doing because he believes he's doing something of crucial importance, not just for himself, but for the whole white race and really the welfare of the whole world. And so it's a heroic task that he set up for himself, and all these petty things that they're throwing in his way, you know, giving his address, having reporters go and talk to his neighbors and cause drama in the neighborhood and so forth. All of that's really very small potatoes compared to what's really at stake here. And so he's moved out. He's safe on the continent. He's going to continue doing his channel, and the channel is going to grow. Now, the press coverage that's been given him
Fantastic.
Was just shocking.
Fantastic.
Just shocking. Yep. Utterly, utterly gutter, tabloid hyperbole. And I think that if anybody actually follows up once they read the article and goes and tries to look at one of Millennial Woz's videos, the contrast could not be more marked.
Exactly. Right?
Between the heavy breathing, ranting tone of this tabloid journalism and his very reasonable, measured, well-spoken videos. I think that anybody who compares what he actually says to what they say about him is going to get a whole red pill about the fake nature of the news media, and they might actually become red-pilled about race and immigration and the problems that he's trying to make people aware of. So honestly, I think in the long run, this is going to be a positive thing for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an opportunity disguised as a crisis. His friends and his listeners have pulled together to help him, and it's going to work out in a very positive way.
While we're on that note, I highly encourage everyone to help Woz out in whatever way you can as well. We'll add a link, to his PayPal so that you guys can help him out while he's in this, you know, transitioning phase, if you will, so that he can eventually then, you know, continue to do videos and everything else. So definitely make sure that you do help Woz out. I think his, you know, approach and his attitude has been unique. It's been tremendously beneficial to get a lot of people into these kinds of ideas and these kinds of thoughts. And that's why I was so surprised, as you say, Greg, that the language in the papers were so... I'm still trying to figure out, wait a minute, maybe they just don't really know, or they didn't really listen. I know that some of these reporters, all they do is they can go through like thousands of hours of material to find that, like, you know, one line where someone talks maybe somewhat favorably about colonialism or slavery or something like that. But in this case, it seems that they were just trying to ramp up this as much as possible to create kind of just a hate wave against Woz, almost to intimidate him out of doing what he's doing or something. I don't know. What do you think?
That's exactly what they're trying to do. I think all of this is based on the extremely triggering and energizing consequences of Hailgate at NPI. That video of people saluting and Richard saying, you know, hail victory and so forth, really got the left wound up. And we're going to be seeing that video for years to come because it's very, very effective at getting people wound up. These people want to be fighting fascism like it's in the 1930s again. They're LARPing, right? They're LARPing as right. The French Resistance. They're LARPing as the commies in Spain or whatever. That's what they're LARPing as. And this is manna from heaven for the narrative. And I think that this has been so triggering and energizing to the left that anybody who was associated with NPI is now coming under extra scrutiny. And Millennial Woz, because Well, he gave a really good speech, and he also did some interviewing at the event. And because his identity was semi-secret, right? Everybody else on that program basically was a public figure. He was the main target for the doxing. I mean, they couldn't dox Matt Tate because Matt Tate's Matt Tate, right? They couldn't dox Kevin McDonald because he's Kevin McDonald. He was like the one guy on the program they could dox. And so they went after him. And they went after him with this head full of nonsense, basically this script that they're fighting against Nazis and, you know, haters and intolerance and so forth. And I don't think any of them bothered to actually look at any of his videos.
No.
I don't think they did. They just imposed this narrative, this template over it. And it's just it's partly a function of the fact that they're lazy. Journalists are very, very lazy people. And it's partly a function of the fact that they're just dishonest. So the long run result of this, though, is going to be good. It's hard on him. He needs your support morally and financially to get through this, but he's going to emerge from this stronger. He's not going to cuck. He's not going to buckle. He's not going to disappear. He's going to come out of this with a bigger platform and a bigger audience and a greater impact. And that's a good thing if people stick with him. And so stick with Millennial Woes. I'm standing with him. He's my friend. I believe in what he's doing, and you should too.
So the lesson to be learned from this and others is, of course, that in the time that we're in and in the era we're in, it has real consequences to talk about these things, and if anything, it demonstrates to us just how the world, you know, perceive many of these ideas and thoughts. And I'm not saying that the world necessarily, actually, as you say, have listened to our ideas or not, but the general consensus is that this is the epitome of evil. It's a moral question, and therefore that's why they go after people in this way. But one of the things I've noticed too, as well, is that there's very little contact between these worlds. There is one, I don't know if it's a danger, but to a certain extent, everyone creates these echo chambers in one way or another. It's kind of like the example you can talk about is like something like Salon, for example. They're on the far, far extreme weirdo left, but them going kind of unchallenged in many ways has turned them from like talking about things about like, you know, feminism and anti-racism to basically now a few years later, you know, more or less pushing like pedophilia. They're like, they've created an echo chamber where their own, you know, ideas are reinforced, and they, you know, it snowballs and voila, now they're here. I'm not sure if that's the case with us, but it shows that we have very few interactions with that other side, that other world. So when these worlds kind of collide and clash, the reactions are so intense. And I mean, I'm not saying that there's a way you can bridge these or whatever, but I wonder sometimes if there's any thought that should be put into trying to reach normies and trying to not tone down the language, because that's also wrong. There's a function with this, you know, kind of, pushing the envelope and kind of being edgy and all that stuff. It's something good there too. But it's a shock to the people involved, maybe, that, oh my God, I didn't know that they would react like this, because we're constantly surrounded by people who always think like us. And it's taking us further into our own kind of direction, if you will, if you see what I'm saying, Greg.
Yeah, I think that what happened with the Hailgate thing is people were brought up short because, yeah, we live in a little kind of echo chamber world where this stuff is funny to us. You listen to the Daily Show and this stuff is funny, and you don't realize that you lose sight of the fact that this does not play with the vast majority of the public.
No, it doesn't.
And if you had to sit down and explain to your mother why you think this pop 'em in the oven stuff is funny, or why you think this oven mitt that you have in a shadow box on your wall, as I do, is funny, it becomes a very, very long, drawn-out process, right? It's not easy to do. And I think it was Hartiste who, in a comment about Hailgate, made the point that we have to realize that a lot of stuff that's funny on forums and message boards, that's ironic and that works, does not work IRL, and especially in front of cameras, because we don't control the context anymore. The enemy controls the context. And what is the context? Well, the context is World War II and every Holocaust documentary that these people have seen and their whole education. And of course, they're going to take it deadly seriously and get really hopped up about it. And that's why the enemy loves this stuff. So we have to be really careful about giving them stuff that fits with their pre-existing paradigms and their pre-existing brainwashing that they've done, because they've spent a lot of time and capital. They've invested a great deal in making National Socialism and anything redolent of that to be the ultimate taboo. And I just don't think that it's effective for us to tie truths that are universal and based on nature and reality and good arguments, right? This is based in biology. This is based in philosophy. This is based in universal truths. And it's true if you're Japanese or Chinese or Swedish or American. I'm talking about ethnic nationalism. This is a universally true ideology. And our enemies want us to do nothing more than to package that with a particular regime that they have spent a great deal of time stigmatizing that existed at a particular time and place in Europe in the interwar period, or between, you know, 1933 and 1945. They would like us to do nothing more because it makes it so easy for them to stigmatize us. So I do think we have to stop falling into that trap. I believe in, as Roger Devlin put it very nicely, our approach should be to be unbending and radical in the substance of what we say and believe, and yet as suave and persuasive as possible in the means by which we persuade people. I think that's a reasonable position. I don't believe in mainstreaming in the sense of hiding our message or watering it down or compromising it. I think that we should keep our message absolutely uncompromised, firm, clear, but we can put forward very radical, firm, clear ideas in very suave and persuasive and non-threatening ways. And I think that's how we need to do this in the future. And I think that we need to stop falling into traps. And in a way, if I look, we can't create the world from scratch, right? If we were going to create a movement from scratch, there are certain things that I would do differently. But that's not the way life is. I came to this by a particular route, and I can't undo my past. But if I were doing this all over from scratch, I would have stayed a little closer to the mainstream, a little further away from interwar fascist ideology, and I think I would be more persuasive and have a greater impact than I do. I think right. that if I were creating the Daily Shoah from scratch, I wouldn't call it the Daily Shoah. Okay. I think that has boxed them in unnecessarily. And the enormous amount of genuinely insightful and really witty political commentary that you find in that show has been somewhat constricted in its ability to persuade and break out because it's boxed as the Daily Shoah. So I think that if we were to start over from scratch, I would have done this stuff differently, but that's not the way the world works, right? You live forward and you understand things backwards, and you usually realize you're making a mistake only after it's written into the permanent record of the universe. So I'm not going to cry over that, but going forward, I do think that we need to be more careful about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then you do have, you know, a crowd that's like kind of, you know, yeah, just no, don't talk about this or slow down or don't, you know, and it's, everything has its time and place. Everything depends on what purpose both each person, but also each outlet has. Who are you trying to target and reach? How you know, is this intended to be mainstream? As you say, for those who have the luxury to think about these things ahead of time, please do. Because, you know, sometimes, most times, there is less thought about much of this, and we cannot do things because it works or it's fun, or sometimes it's just, as you say, the reality just keeps on rolling on, and you comment on things, and then all of a sudden you're just, you know, hit, you run right into the wall, and you realize what happened, because there is this, just as you say, an echo chamber. There's a constant reinforcement that this is fun, this is blah blah blah. But if your intentions were to maybe reach a newer audience or something, that's going to be more and more you know, difficult to do. Saying that, though, one of the questions that I'd like to ask you, Greg, is do you think, though, that we have pushed back the left and their arguments between, let's say, the Trump win, with the kind of more or less open attacks that we have now from a lot of people on the mainstream media, and the charges against, you know, the internationalists, the globalists, you know, even using that kind of rhetoric, globalists and elitists and stuff. This is something that's really caught on during the Trump election, and it's been really beneficial to us. And I see that we've managed to push the envelope, and therefore I also see there is a need and a role that more extreme outlets kind of fill. They do, to a certain extent, blaze the trail open so that people can fill that wake that they have left behind and say, well, you know, at least I'm not that extreme, and they're kind of a little bit more comfortable in some of the opinions that maybe they wouldn't have if they were at the tip of the spear and not, you know, and if they were on the front lines.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think things have been going very, very well for us recently. I think that there are two reasons for that. One, the left has made such a terrible mess of everything. They've created an unsustainable, ruinous situation in every white country, and the right has gone along with it. The phony right, the center right, has gone along with it. So both groups are really responsible, but the vanguard of decadence is the left. They've made a terrible mess of things. It's unsustainable, and more people are becoming aware of it through painful necessity. They're seeing their countries invaded. They're seeing their neighborhoods destroyed. They're seeing their children raped and abused. They're seeing their old family members abused. It's a terrible situation. And we have a plausible explanation for why it happened and a plausible solution that will stop it. So that is arguing in our favor. And also, we have a means of getting our message out to our people now. We have our own media, like Red Ice, like Countercurrents, like the Daily Show, like TRS. We've got our own media now. We've got the internet, and we're reaching out and doing an end run around the mainstream media and getting this message to our people. I do think that there's a role for extremists and agitators and triggerers, but I think that that's somewhat overrated. And I think that I believe that there's got to be more to this than simply triggering leftists and making them angry.
Of course.
And you can do all kinds of really stupid things to get publicity. Gavin McGinnis has a dirty dildo in a drawer somewhere as his as a reminder of the kind of stuff you can do to get publicity. Not all publicity is good publicity. And we have to realize that. And also we have to realize that sometimes bad publicity can undo a lot of very careful, painful work at creating real world institutions and networks. And the best example of that is what has happened in the Whitefish Kalispell area with my friend April Gady, who's been there for years trying to help white nationalist people get settled in this very nice area. It's a beautiful part of the country, a very white area, very healthy environment, great place to raise your kids. A lot of people have come there, and they've quietly settled down and become part of the community. And this Love Lives Here group, which is run by a couple of Jews, predictably, right?
Yep.
They were always they were there. They were agitating. They were trying to get people all excited about this. And for the most part, the community was not easily excited by this. Now, since Andrew Anglin announced a fake troll, namely this armed march of Nazis in Whitefish, Montana, which he never intended to have happen, It was just a troll to piss off liberals in the media and get attention. Now Love Lives Here is having meetings and 200 people are showing up at them. It has energized the opposition in that community, and it has demoralized our people, and it's made a far less conducive environment to people actually building a real-world white community and raising families and advancing our cause in the way that it has to be advanced in the real world. So my feeling is that at the present time, there's a split in the movement. And it's become very, very clear since November that this is a difficult split, and it's a source of conflict. The split is between people who are creating real-world communities and networks and people who simply think that all they need to do and all they want to do is troll. Because if all you do is troll, you basically get this attitude that any publicity is good publicity. If you piss off liberals enough, that's great. My challenge to these people is, hey, well, why don't you piss off liberals so much that we lose our First and Second Amendments? That'd be a great troll, right? You can get them really pissed off so they shred the goddamn Constitution. Obviously, that's really stupid, but that's the path that these people are on. And I think that in effect, what we've got is a troll's veto. You know, trolls can veto anything because, well, they're anonymous. And they don't think about consequences. They often don't know what's actually happening on the ground anywhere. And there's just a certain nihilism here. And we have to figure out some way that we can stop the troll's veto when it conflicts with real world organizing and institution building and community building. I don't know how to do that yet. I think what has to happen is we have to have more people conversing with one another at the higher levels of this movement so that we don't step on one another's toes, right? I think that's the direction that we need to go in, but we're not quite there yet. So that's a big issue in my mind, though, mm-hmm. And that's something that's highly desirable. We need some coordination. We need some back channel coordination, and we need to have a sense of what's more important. And what's most important is actually building communities and gaining power, real world power. And to the extent that publicity supports that, it's good. To the extent that it detracts from that, it's bad. There is such thing as bad publicity.
You know, there's, I hear what you're saying, and also at the same time, to kind of look at this from the other side, it's polarization seems to be part of it, and you're not going to be able to escape kind of this doubling down. Ultimately, this is an existential conflict, and in that, you're not going to be able to, back away. And the other problem of this is that there's so many differing intentions, so many different will powers out there, and there's people maybe who are not as genuine, right? And they are there to antagonize. They're there to, whether it backfires or not, it seems to be largely uncontrollable. But I hear what you're saying in terms of being at least from a upper level thoughts behind it of like, okay, let's try to do this in the right way. I just don't think you're going to be able to achieve that at this stage, to be honest, because there's so many different willpowers and intention. And I think that this was the problem with the rise of the alt-right also, partially, was the decentralized nature of it, which is a great advantage. But we saw how the media dealt with this. They vehemently try to find, well, who's the face of the alt-right, right? They always want to personalize the story, and they just can't obviously summarize what it is about as a movement. They have to, they go for Milo, they go for Cernovich, they go for these people to try to explain this is what's happening. But the fracturing, Greg, that you talk about, I think, I said to you earlier before we started, I see it as a cell division. It's growth because there's more people coming into these lines of thoughts and understanding the arguments, and as you have more people, there is going to be splits. There's going to be people breaking off, and I just hope that there's cohesiveness enough that it's still, that all these different cells still operate as a larger organism in a bigger body. That's what I hope.
Yeah, because the alternative is for these cells to become cancers, tumors, right? And to ruin the larger organism. And so, yeah, I believe that we can add by subtracting, we can strengthen ourselves by dividing, and so forth. If we have disagreements, we should shake hands and divide and go our separate ways rather than fight. I like that. But there still has to be, on some level, a cooperation for the larger good, a superordination towards the larger good, or subordination towards the larger good of each cell, right? And when a cell in the body, or a clump of cells in the body, is rogue, right? If it's not working for the overall health of the body, that's what we call a cancer. That's what we call a tumor. And there's some tumors around here. There's some anarchic elements around here in this movement. And I don't know what to do with them. You can't really cut them out because this is internet, right? They can, you know, Trotsky couldn't come back with a sock puppet once he got the axe, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, we can't give people the axe in the old-fashioned way. We can't purge people like they purged them in the USSR. And all this talk about purging is just LARPing, in my opinion. So we've got a movement where its great strength and its great weakness is the fact that it is decentralized, largely anonymous, and on the internet. And as long as it works net to our benefit, I guess we have to accept that. And generally what's happening is we go two steps forward, one step back, but we are going forward. And the more we can learn from our mistakes, maybe it'll be 2.5 steps forward and one step back eventually, and 3 steps forward and 1 step back. I'd like to see this accelerating a bit, because events are accelerating around us, and I would like our movement to accelerate with them and maybe get out ahead of them, because we need to provide the leadership, the memes, the community, the institutions, the structures that are going to have to be in place to make real political change in the direction that we want possible.
Very good. So what can you say about doxing and how to protect yourself? We had a contributor write about this on Red Eyes just a couple of weeks ago, almost prophetically, I guess, in a way, because we've had a number of things occur since that point. We've had, I believe, Seventh Son address was posted on Medium. That was taken down abruptly. Spencer's address was posted, I think it was on Politico. The author urging baseball bats. I believe the guy who wrote that, he was later fired. We, of course, have this with Mike Enoch. I can't recall now where info about him was first published, but it spread like wildfire. Obviously, understandably, people are afraid of doxing. And just like millennial woes, I think this is not primarily, but another big agenda that this fulfills is that it scares away other people that have these kinds of ideas. They think, oh my God, this is too much. I can't take this. I'm going to run away from this. It's a way of trying to puncturing the momentum that we've had. And I don't think that it should be reason enough, to be honest. There, we have to have a realization that we're not going to get out of this unscathed and being comfy. This is a struggle. This is an existential struggle. There have to be sacrifices along the way, whether we like that or not. And I think that that is what is happening now because of the momentum that we have. They have fought back and they have done certain things successfully. But I think there has to be and I don't know how to achieve this, but somehow there needs to be just a unified ambition to say that this doesn't work anymore. We don't care if it happens. There has to be enough organization to help these people out. If they are indeed fired from their job or whatever, do take it to the legal level. As Emily Yukas, she was also fired, for example. There's another one I left out. This need to be fought on every level that we can, and we shouldn't just give up. There need to be set precedents that they can't discriminate against, you know, people that have certain political opinions that these employers don't agree with or whatever. So I see it as you know, a united front doesn't work. You can't intimidate us. Fight legally. Help each other out. Back each other up financially if and when people lose their jobs. And then fight back in that measure of saying there is enough of us now and enough of us ready to be open and vocal about this that it doesn't matter. What do you think, Greg?
I agree. Eventually, we want a world where everybody can be an open white nationalist and it's leftists who are hiding their identities under pseudonyms on the internet. I want to be in a world where we can be open because we run everything. We set the political agenda. We have cultural and political hegemony, and basically people on the far left, people who hate white people, the ones who are still in our countries, right, they will be as marginalized and secretive as pedophiles. That's the goal that I want. So how do we get from here to there? Well, we need more explicit white nationalists. We need more people who are out there under their own names. And we're going to get that eventually. It's going to happen. It's slowly happening. And once we get to a certain tipping point, it's just not going to be a threat to dox us. And we're just not quite there yet, but we have to think about ways that we can get there. And obviously having support networks in place for people who are doxed is very important. And there are two things that I would like to do. And I talked about this with Patrick LeBrun a couple of years ago. And I tried to get a meeting with this lawyer, but it didn't happen. Basically because of movement drama, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, that's why it didn't happen. But we had this idea that, okay, first of all, everybody needs to read SJW's Always Lie by Vox Day, because he's got some extremely good advice about what to do if these people dox you and are coming after your job. Everybody needs to read that. That should be the first thing. We should hand that out to everybody who gets doxed, or just they should read it. They should have already read it. Now, one thing that happens all the time, you hear about it every 6 months or so, is there will be a person, a police chief, a police officer, a reporter, a politician, who says something honest and true about race or Jews. And immediately they are attacked and they end up resigning or getting fired from their jobs or issuing apologies and so forth. And the left basically chalks up another win. What would it be like, though, if one or two of these people stood their ground? This is what I call it, the Stand Your Ground Project. What would it be like if we had a really slick lawyer, somebody who's plausible, articulate, credentialed, and a long winning history behind him? If we had a person who would call this politician or reporter or whatever up within hours of the story breaking and say, this is what's going to happen to you, and this is what you need to do if you're going to preserve your job, preserve your career, preserve your standing in the community. And, you know, we could have somebody there within 24 hours to sit down with them and talk them through this if they need it and outline a program to stand their ground. Because if we can get just a few people to stand up once this firestorm comes out, that is going to weaken the enemy. And it's going to encourage our people. That's why the enemy attacks so ferociously. I used to think that Jews, and it's really largely Jewish organizations like the ADL or the SPLC that attack these people. I used to think these people were really, really paranoid, because they would come at somebody who makes the most innocuous statement if they're a public figure. Any public figure who makes an innocuous statement with a little bit of truth about Jews or race is attacked ferociously. They come at them with elephant guns blazing. And I thought, this is just paranoia. But then I came to think, no, this isn't paranoia. I started having experiences when I was living in Berkeley, California, which has got to be the most lefty, crazy place on earth, where left-wing liberals, if they felt comfortable, would start talking about the Jewish problem. And I came to realize that these people's power is very, very shallow. And that is why they put out, they leap on every little spark. They send 6 fire trucks out to put out a single spark, because they know that if a spark catches, it can be a forest fire, and it will exceed their ability to control it. So they have to go at it intensely at the very beginning. Our level of ethnocentrism and awareness is at a very, very low ebb, whereas our enemies are working at 99% of their capacity to keep it contained. And that means if there's a small jump in our awareness, that can exceed their ability to suppress it. So what we need to do is we need to jump in when there's a chance of getting anybody to stand their ground, because that will encourage others and that might go viral. Now, this is also true of doxing. And it's unfortunate that sometimes people turn tail and run when they're doxed. If we can find ways of giving them moral support, financial support, and just getting them to stand their ground, I think that doxing will lose its power. Now, another thing about doxing is that they can only do it once.
Yeah.
Right? Once you're doxed, it's out there. You can't be undoxed. And this is why people shouldn't run away from it, honestly, because it's, you know, running away doesn't work. You can't undo it. But it only works once, and they can only dox us all once. And then once we're all doxed, it just loses its power. So I'm hopeful that in the coming years, as we get more resources, more activists, more people who can actually mount initiatives, that we will have something like this Stand Your Ground project in place, where we can go to people who speak the truth and buck them up, and where we can help people who are doxxed stand their ground and not run away. And if enough people do that, then suddenly there can be a sea change in the culture. So that's what I hope will happen. And I think that as more of us get doxxed, more content creators like Millennial Woes, like Mike Enoch, like Seventh Son, it's just going to empower them in the long run. In the short run, it's very upsetting. They get all kinds of family drama. They might have to move. They lose a job and so forth. But what happens is at that point, they don't have anything to lose anymore. They don't have any mainstream cred left to lose. And that is very liberating. What's the song, me and Bobby McGee, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose? Well, if they give us nothing left to lose, they make us much more dangerous and potent. And Millennial Woes is going to be a much more dangerous and potent enemy now. And Mike Enoch is going to be a much more dangerous and potent enemy. The TRS people who have been doxxed and who are standing their ground are going to be far more effective advocates. And I think that that's really, really important. Machiavelli talks about how when you're besieging an enemy, you always need to leave them with an avenue of escape, right? Why? Because if their backs are to the wall, they'll fight really hard and it'll cost you more to defeat them. But if they have a way of escape, you can drive them from their castle, right? And take it at less cost. Now, the left is crazy, basically. They don't have any brakes. They don't have any self-control. They want to destroy us and give us no exit. But that just redounds to our benefit. That just makes us stronger. Because if they don't kill us, and they're not going to be killing us, not yet. They might try it someday when they get really, really desperate. But if they take away everything and leave us alive, then we've got nothing left to lose, and we're going to be much, much more vicious, effective, dangerous enemies. That's what they're creating. They're creating the conditions of their own undoing. But that's what they've been doing all along.
Yeah, I mean, we also have to continue to show that their responses is absolutely hysterical and not proportionate to the issue, kind of what they did with Woes, as you say. It's overplaying their hand. These six fire trucks that you're talking about coming to, you know, put out a little ember somewhere. I think that people are also watching that, and we need to continue to bring attention to that. That it's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? These so-called hate watch groups, they are definitely overplaying their hand and reacting in ways which are completely disproportionate to the issue at hand. I don't know if the majority and the masses feel that way yet, but I feel, and whether we have made tremendous headway in the last couple of years with normies starting to question, and as I said before, just as how the rhetoric changed during the Trump election, with many people, you know, using rhetoric and things that, you know, we talked about in alternative media circles like 10 years ago, and there's just so many more people there. I would even go so far to say that on the question of JQ, I see people dropping in on that every single day. More people are just, you know, opening their eyes and questioning the simplest of facts, like double standards of, wait a minute, why can't we, you know, talk about this issue, or why can't we raise awareness about the truth of the matter when it comes to, you know, who controls media or who controls banking or any of these things. So I think that we're making tremendous headway, and we have to keep going at it. And I think that their responses is indicative of the fact that they are starting to act like desperate, you know, cornered animals, I guess, as you say. It's just a matter of which escape route do we leave them with as more and more people coming over to our side.
Yeah, I'd like to leave them with California as their escape route.
Yeah.
I love this idea of Cal Exit. I wrote an article called In Praise of Cal Exit at Countercurrents, just arguing that that would be an enormously useful thing for the future of white people in America if the state of California would separate from the United States, because we'd lose a significant percentage of our non-white population and a significant percentage of whites who are hopelessly liberal and leftist. The Democratic Party would lose 55 electoral votes, which is more than a quarter of what they need to win the presidency. And we'd have fewer but better Americans. But that's an aside. Yeah, we do need to leave them an exit and hope that they take it. And a Cal exit would be a nice exit indeed. So I do think we're winning. I think that the reason why they're so hysterical is that they're losing. And we need to keep that in mind. We need to keep a perspective on that. They are hysterical because they are losing. And we're just going to keep punching, right? We're not going to stop.
No, of course not.
As they dox people, those who do not flee become more powerful enemies. If you strike me down, I will be more powerful than ever, right? I hate using Star Wars memes, but hey, no one reads Shakespeare anymore, so I got to use Star Wars. But that's the situation. They tried to strike millennial woes down, and he is risen more powerful than ever before. And it's going to be the same with Mike Enoch and Seventh Son and a whole range of other people who have been doxxed. They will all be back, even the ones who have taken a break. You know, they're working on some personal stuff, but they'll be back, and they'll be stronger than ever.
Yeah, and it's so much more than, you know, our plight is so much more than also what just goes on the internet and people there. We have, you know, tremendous more than that to lose. I mean, what we should be worried about is what is happening in our countries, how they're being overrun, the fact that the borders are open, and to a certain part of me wishes that this kind of reaction, if you will, that we've seen to some of this would be equal when it comes to the reality of the world, of what is happening right now, and that the energized reactions would be equal when it comes to pushing back against those kinds of ideas. Ultimately, I think that we have much more to lose than most leftists. I know that some of them, they view this as you say before, kind of, this is self-defense. They think that they're fighting the rise of Nazi Germany. This is, it's always 1939 or 7 or whatever. And they see this, of course, also as an existential threat. So I'm not saying that it's less for them, but ultimately I think that we have a realization that we have more to lose. To them, it seems that they are more interested in just wrecking everything and just screwing everything up and defacing everything, making everything degenerate. We want to actually build something up. We want to preserve something. We want to create something. And it's much more difficult to be in our position as well. I think it's much more It's much easier to just thrash and smash and hit at everything that has been created, and it's easier to critique. But at the end of the day, once that critiquing has been made, once you've destroyed something, there's not going to be much there for them at all. They're not building this out of a reality that they want to create something that is better. And that's something I think that we have to our advantage, that we have much more to lose. We have much more behind us in terms of what we can bring to the table in the realization of our fight.
Yes and no. The left has a certain systematic advantage. They used to pretend like they were building a utopia. Now they just want to destroy. And it's very clear that they're just engaged in destruction. And it's easier to create chaos than order. It's easier to destroy than create. It takes a lot of time and effort to build a house. It takes only a few seconds to light a match and burn it down. And that gives them a systematic advantage, because they really are just nihilists at this point. And so we've got to bear that in mind, right? We have to work to overcome that disadvantage. It's always harder to build than it is to destroy. It's always harder to create order than chaos. And they're in the business of chaos, and we're in the business of order. So we've got a greater struggle than they do. It's easier for them to get what they want than it is for us to get what we want. That said, in the end, chaos is death, right? Chaos is destruction. It's chaos is not a world that anybody can live in, even these sick, deluded people who want it.
Yeah.
So we have to win. We have to win, because otherwise the world is going to be a burnt out cinder.
Yeah, no, right? It's true.
That's what's at stake.
Yeah. Speaking of which, let's just talk a bit about the deplorable and what came out just here a couple of days ago with the anti-fascist coalition there in Washington, D.C., Luke Kuhn and some of the other guys there. It was revealed by Project Veritas, James O'Keefe. Very interesting. They were talking about using butyric acid to actually put this, to trigger this. I guess it's triggered with, was it water or some kind of, they were talking about some kind of reaction, which basically they wanted to put this in the ventilation system of the National Press Club building where, Cernovich and all these others holding their deplorable. I think that's on Thursday, the day before the inauguration. We'll see what comes out of this, but it's pretty interesting. There's of course a number of things we can talk about here of Cernovich, double standards of doing the very thing he criticized Spencer for. But anyway, let's talk for a moment about what kind of people we're dealing with here, like these maniacs, lunatics like Luke Kuhn. I don't know if you saw the video yet, but they're sitting talking in Comet Ping Pong of all places. The renowned pizza, like pedo pizza place, about using this and basically attack the deplorable. It's just insanity. I don't know if you heard of any of this yet, Greg.
I it's been on the edge of my awareness because of all the TRS drama, which I've been at the center of. So I'm not quite fully apprised of this. It is ironic that the left is resorting to gas chamber tactics, isn't it?
For their opinions, yeah, exactly. Or for who they are. Yeah, it is. It's amazing. And also, of course, this shows us how the opposition that we're facing, the left, views us. We might have our internal drama about whether it's alt-light or alt-right or alt-Reich or whatever the hell it is, anime-right or, the rhetoric they used is that the deplorable, they're all literally neo-Nazis, they're just fascist, and they want to gas Jews and everything, they want to kill black people, so we have to, their view is like, we have to stop these people. And then of course under all of this there's a tug of war going on between these factions, and the people who are attending deplorable just kind of pushing out someone like Baked Alaska because of the fact that he did address the JQ. So he was supposedly, quote, too Nazi for them. And it's this whole drama. But to the left, it doesn't matter. They all view us the same. And I just find that interesting. And I think we should keep that in mind sometimes, that it's like, and I'm not saying, well, therefore, ergo, we can all just, you know, go full 1488 and everyone should. That's not what I mean either. I'm just saying that they view us as these, you know, just vile extremists, and they were going to take care of you, whether it's someone who's as mellow as Alex Jones or whether it's, you know, the Daily Stormer or something like that.
Yeah, we need to recognize that, you know, there's not some sort of blood of the lamb that we can put up there so these people will pass over us. They just see us all as evil honkies who deserve to die. Yep. When you get right down to it.
Yep.
Years ago, Jim Goad wrote some piece about liberal leftists, liberal white types, anti-racist types, and he called it white Passover syndrome. And he basically said that all of these people are trying to signal that they're good white people, so, you know, the race war will pass them by. And it just doesn't work that way. These people don't make fine distinctions between good white people and bad white people. And it's just a vain, silly notion to think that that's going to happen. So there's not something that you can put out there that's going to cause them to pass you by. We're all just whitey to them.
Yeah, exactly. And at that point, it doesn't matter what people think or that they can choose something. I mean, if you have a large movement, a group of people, a race of people even, you know, rallying behind their own in response to opposition to another group, they will view you as being part of that group if you're white. And that's it. You won't have any choice. You won't have any option. And sometimes I wonder about some of these other people who are like constantly signaling in denouncing those who are a little bit further to the right. I think I usually bring up something like The Rebel as a perfect example of this, where they talk about free speech and you know, moving the goalpost of what should be acceptable to include what they think is acceptable, like criticizing Islam in Europe or something like that, right? But as soon as you have someone who goes a little bit further than they do, they're as willing as the mainstream media of calling these people names. And it was even actually the case now with Woz, where, you know, and again, I hate to attack these people or whatever, but it needs to be pointed out that, you know, Lauren Southern was talking about, you know, quote, internet fascists in reference to Woz, and talking about the fact that, oh my God, mainstream media, please, please don't do the mistake of just, you know, calling these people names and not addressing any of their points, because then people might actually believe that it's true, right? So her greatest fear, oh my God, God help us all if these fascists rise up. You know, because then we're all in trouble. My point is, at the end of the day, these people who are her enemies, they're not going to see those distinctions. She's going to be dragged into this whether she wants to or not. And that's, I guess, what people say about the wheels of history. They keep turning on. There's massive polarization going on. And at some point, you just have to make a decision. Like, okay, are you there to defend yourself and your own group? Or are you just going to be gobbled up in this, you know, in this conflict that is on the rise right now?
Right. Look, the people at the Deplorable are all a bunch of evil right-wing honkies, and they can talk about their Western values and stuff like that all they want, but when there's an actual battle, it's going to be based on skin color. That's what's going to be going on. And they might have their token blacks and Asians there, right? But it's still a racial struggle as far as the left is concerned. And we need to get that through our thick heads, right? You might not want those people to single you. You might not want those people to be your enemies in a racial struggle, but sometimes you don't get to pick your enemies. Your enemies pick you.
That's right.
The aggressor has an advantage. They choose you as the person they're going to attack. And if they choose to attack you on the basis of your race, you can't defend yourself on some other ground, right? If they choose to attack you by sea, you can't go and defend yourself by land, right?
Right.
That you got to go where they attack, and the attack is on race. It's not about Western values like Colin Liddell wants to make it. It's about race. And the enemy has chosen that front, and we have to respond on that front. And this is an argument from Roger Devlin. It's one of the best things he ever wrote in a piece called Why I Write. Basically, he says that a lot of conservatives think, yeah, well, race is not everything, and it's not the most important thing. And these arguments are academic because it's a battle, and the enemy has chosen to attack on the race front. That means that you can't choose to counterattack on some other grounds. You can't do that. And the sooner they learn that, the better. Maybe a little butyric acid in the event, in the vents might be a red-pilling thing.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't happen. But it might. I understand that butyric acid just smells bad. I don't think they're actually going to try and kill them.
Right. No. Right? No. Exactly. It's just more.
It's not Zyklon D.
Fun to talk about gas, but yeah. Anyway, it's a metaphorical gassing of the people in there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a gas chamber meme. That's These people right. should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah. That's so. Right. So yeah. This. I mean, Western values. It's like, okay. Well, who's going to defend these values, and where did these values even arise from to begin with? I mean, it seems that these, you know, again, I'm back at the rebel camp now, but these conservatives and people on this mellow, you know, right to a certain extent, they're like, what they want is like, they want a, they're okay with the slow genocide of,
exactly.
of white people. It's like, how fast do you want it to go? Should we have, you know, while we're saying, no, like, stop it now, this is just too much, let's end it. And they're saying, well, we don't see skin color. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we're replaced by, you know, Indians and Chinese people eventually. Just as long as they adopt, you know, Western values, everything will be fine. I almost see it as a, it's a bigger mistake to a certain extent. At least now, Greg, we're at a position where when things are moving so fast that they do, that's like mass awakening people. If these people had their way, it would simply slow down to the point where people would be, it would be more unnoticeable that they are being replaced.
It's a slow boiling of the frog. Yeah, I want it to be fast. I want it to be accelerated. Exactly. And this is one of the reasons why I fear the right, the kind of kosher right, getting into power. And I don't include Trump in that, because he actually wants to address the demographic problems in terms of immigration. But the last thing I want is something like a Ron Paul presidency, where he puts a system where we don't have a long-term future because of demographic problems. He takes that system and puts it on firmer fiscal footing, right? So it doesn't have any economic crises that might cause it to break down. I want the thing to break down, damn it. Yeah. I don't want better government in a society where our genocide is baked into the system. I don't want that at all. I want chaos more than good government if we are not going to address the demographic problems. To the extent that Trump is addressing that through immigration, I think he's a good guy. But I don't want good government in a bad system that's essentially genocidal against white people. That's just insane. But that's what a lot of sort of Republican types are going to give us. The thing about the Western values people, the people like Gavin McGinnis, is that basically they recognize that these values that they defend were created by white people, but they are capitulating to multiculturalism and saying that it's the values, not the people, that matter. They're just capitulating to multiculturalism.
Yeah.
The alt-right is a form of multiculturalism. It's just a civic nationalist form of multiculturalism, an anti-PC, anti-Muslim, anti-feminist form of multiculturalism. But it's still the same multicultural problem, and it's founded on the same kinds of lies. The basic lie is that race is not relevant to politics and that values are the key. It's a form of the proposition nation, which is a false idea. Civic nationalism basically says that you can unify a country based on a creed and a political system, whereas ethnic nationalism argues that the true unity of a society that flourishes is ethnic. It's based on ties of blood as well as a common culture. But there's got to be that blood tie, that the extended family. That's really what a nation is. It's an extended family that has a common culture.
Yeah, they don't seem to see any value in that. They maybe to some extent they maybe understand it, but they just don't see it valuable enough to address it. It's like anybody who does bring up the, whether it's racial differences or maybe, you know, again, a little bit more extreme, the JQ or something like that, they're quickly there to denounce those people. But right. I think they're going to have a rude awakening at some point and realize that it's like, listen, it doesn't matter. Or it's like, at some point, we're not going to let it come to this, of course, but what I'm saying is that at some point, if we would just let this mass migration and invasion go unabated, they would at some point, I think, wake up and like realize like, oh, what the hell have I done, right? Advocating for a complete replacement of our people without realizing it.
Well, one of the alt-light tropes is they say, oh, we're against identity politics. But when you look at it, actually, the alt-light is a form of identity politics.
Of course, absolutely.
It's a form of identity politics of people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who's Jewish or part Jewish, Cernovich, who's ambiguously Jewish, Molyneux, who's half Jewish. I guess Milo's supposed to be half Jewish, too. Or Paul Joseph Watson, who's allegedly married to an Asian woman, or Gavin McGinnis, who's married to an American Indian woman. The alt-light is the identity politics of cosmopolitan diaspora Jews and white race mixers. It is a position that they can take because it's congenial to them. Fits with their identity and their lifestyle choices. Well, that's fine. That's all well and good. I want them to be out there making arguments for civic nationalism as opposed to globalism. It's an improvement. Yeah, it's great when they attack feminism and political correctness and so forth. But because of who they are, they can't get on board with the deeper, truer ethnic nationalist picture. But I can't blame them for that. They're just being authentic for who they are. And we have to do more to bring over the people who are listening to them to the full truth. We have to offer a critique of what they're saying and show that there's a lot of truth in what they're doing, but it's inadequate. There's a certain element of special pleading there. It's a half measure. It's not going to really solve the problem. You've got to come all the way to the racial nationalist camp. And so I look at these people as primarily an opportunity to partially, to purple pill people, I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
And we'll red pill them. So, I mean, that's the only way that you can really have a constructive attitude towards them, because they're not going to go away. We can attack them, we can mock them, but they're not going to go away. They're very entrenched. They have a large audience. They're very effective at monetizing their platforms. And they're not going to disappear just because we disapprove of them, but we can steal their best people away from them. And that's what we're doing. We really are doing that. So, it's the future belongs to us, not them. They are a unstable transitional point on the political spectrum to the positions that we take.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
If people who are white without any mixed, I guess, mixed identities or mixed loyalties are in their audience, they can come all the way to us. Whereas these guys, because of who they are, they can't really be us. And I don't blame them for not being us. But, in the end, I would applaud them if they would make the sacrifice of saying, and this is what Vox Dei does, and this is why I admire the guy. Vox Dei is a person of mixed race, and he says, I believe in racial nationalism. I don't believe in civic nationalism. I believe in racial nationalism. It's the only natural system, even though I might not fit in to these racial nationalist things. Now, you can say he's a hypocrite, but I think that truth is more important than integrity, meaning not being a hypocrite. Yeah, so he can so he may preach things that he cannot practice. What's more important is what he preaches, not the guy, but the message. Not the messenger, but the message. And he's making a kind of sacrifice, if you will, a kind of sacrifice of personal integrity or authenticity to speak certain truths that I think are very important. And he's actually very helpful to us because he is an outsider who's making a declaration against his own personal interests of the truth of what we're saying. That's very useful.
Yeah, and we need, and certainly I welcome those people. We had a guy on, Frank Raymond, from he's living in Canada. He's from the Indian subcontinent, you know, very outspoken in favor of white people. And let's face it, I mean, many who are normies and many who are like have been brought up on this staple food of like it's very, very dangerous and evil to talk about race or talk about racial differences or anything like that. They are going to be, whether we like it or not, they're going to be more prone listening to someone who's brown for whatever reason. Somehow they consider that to be more legitimate. Objectively, it isn't, of course, but I'm saying it serves a very good purpose and we should welcome that. Why not? You know, what's irritating with the Paul Joseph Watsons is, and I think you're right here, Greg, too. I don't know if they fully realize it or not, or if there's a defense mechanism that has kicked in there that they've maybe made choices that they, they're stuck with them now or whatever. But they end up in a position where they continuously are denouncing those evil Nazis, right? It's always everyone of those a Nazi or the real fascists or something like that. And they just cannot come to our, they don't even have to be outspoken. They can just like, don't address it then or something at least, right? Instead of this continuous counter signaling, and they will just never come to support us and the struggle that we have, that will continuously denounce us. And although that they work as a bridge, I think, as you say, that's why I think that the most efficient way that we can use them is to attack their points, attack their logic, and show that why they are simply wrong and why the racial component is the single most important one when it comes to national cohesion and creating countries that are peaceful instead of just this endless conflict state that they're in now.
Right. I've never accepted the idea that, well, Milo is a gateway drug, so don't attack him. Don't criticize him. It only works by criticizing him. Now, there are different ways of criticizing people or attacking people. One is to offer better arguments, and the other is basically the trolling route, right? And, I'm weary of the trolling thing, okay? I've never been wholly comfortable with it.
Yet it seems to work in for some people, obviously.
It does seem to work. But, you know, it's like nuclear war or germ warfare or gas warfare. You might release the poison gas, but it's going to blow back on you sometime. And it creates a milieu of denigration and suspicion and intrigue and hatred. It creates a kind of madhouse atmosphere in our movement that I think is damaging and repulsive to a lot of people. I can't stop it, but we do need to be aware of its limitations. My approach to somebody like Milo is basically to give better arguments, to just say, okay, Milo, that's all well and good, but look, civic nationalism is a phony ideology. Race is more important than, civic values and shared Western values, whatever that really boils down to. And so we just got to keep that critique running. And I think that will bring more people over because they don't have any good answers against that. Their position is just a compromise position. Really, it's an unstable, untenable compromise position, and eventually it's just going to fail.
Yep, exactly. Very, very good point. Well, again, we have to continue to address these issues. We have to come with, as you say, better arguments, and sometimes the delivery matters. It can be, humorous or kind of edgy or denigrating or, you know, whatever, but sometimes that works better for some people. There's never going to be a one solution to, you know, reining them all in and all that kind of stuff. So that's what we have, a diversity, if you will, of people trying different avenues, trying different routes. bringing different things to the table, and it is a combined effort that is very efficient after all, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And look, I'm an old man by comparison to most of these people, so this might just be my age speaking, right? But you know, I do think that the route that I'm going to take, what I'm most comfortable with, what I do well, is try to offer the better arguments. I can get down there and meme with the youngsters, and I don't seem like a total dork, I hope. But I think the argument route is better. So anyway, that's basically where I am on the Milo question and the alt-light question.
Greg, let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk a bit about Mike Enoch, the doxing there, the consequent fallout and everything else. And it, at this point, I haven't looked into it. I've seen a lot of rumors, a lot of things flying around online that I haven't been able to confirm. I haven't spoken with, you know, Mike personally. So I've kind of just, I just kind of want to stay out of it for now and see how this goes and see what happens, because there's been just tremendous amounts of reaction to all of this. As usual, as there always is when these kinds of things kind of blow up, if you will. But so I'm going to kind of leave it up to you a little bit and give us your take on what happened and where are you with all of this. And do you understand the critics? I guess they feel betrayed to a certain extent by some information coming out here and stuff like that. And then at the same time, I see an overreaction as well. What's your, what do you feel about all this?
Well, I just published an article today called Why I Support Mike Enoch, so that'll give everybody a headline about where this is going to go. I've known Mike for more than 2 years, which is almost an eternity in this kind of movement that we have today. It's growing so fast. But, I mean, I know people who have gotten into this so recently that they actually voted for Hillary Clinton, and now they're on the alternative right. It's people are red pilling that fast.
Sometimes
it's,
you forget that. That's a good point, actually.
It's a blur. Yeah, it's a blur. There are so many new people coming into this who have a very sketchy understanding of any of the history of this, but it's happening. And because it's growing so fast, half the people who are reading our websites today are probably still doing something that we did a long time ago, which is screwing up our courage to read things that are a little edgy. Today, it seems like second nature to us. We don't think about it. But there was a time when we had to be a little, you know, we had to screw up our courage. We had to work on our gut just to look at crazy ideas on the internet. A lot of people are there today right now. But that's a good situation to be in because it means that we're growing dramatically. Anyway, Mike Enoch is somebody that I've known for more than 2 years. I first heard about The Daily Show in November of 2014 at an event, a Countercurrents event, from Charles Kraft, who likes podcasts because he spends a lot of time painting on porcelain, and so he likes some noise in the background. So he listens to a lot of shows, and he told me about The Daily Show. When I got back to New York, I tuned in, and I really enjoyed it. I came to be a fan of it very quickly. And then I was invited to this NRX party, the neo-reactionary party, get together in Manhattan, in Hell's Kitchen, actually. So I heard Mike's voice. And so I went up and introduced myself, and we struck up a conversation. And he gave me his normie email address, which has his actual name in it. So on the long train ride home, I took out my smartphone and I typed in his name and did a Google search. And one of the things that came up with were the Friedman-Painovic wedding photos. So I knew his wife had a Jewish surname. And I didn't know how Jewish she was, but I knew that that was going to be a problem somewhere down the road. Obviously, he wasn't a full-blown white nationalist yet. He didn't even call himself a white nationalist until the following February, a few months later, after he came back from American Renaissance. But his evolution was in the direction of white nationalism, and they were talking about the Jewish question. They were basically a bunch of ex-libertarians talking to one another, educating one another, educating themselves in public. And because they had such interesting, appealing personalities, and it was intermixed with a lot of satire and shitposting, it was very audience engaging, and they were bringing their audience along in their wake. And I thought that The Daily Show was a tremendously important educational project, and I knew that it would grow. And it's grown enormously since then. So I thought this is very valuable, but this is eventually going to come out and it's going to be a big problem. I didn't know where Mike was going to go on the Jewish thing, but I predicted, based on the fact that his wife had a Jewish surname, that he'd probably end up sort of in what we call the alt-light territory today, right? Sort of Jared Taylor-y, perhaps. But to my surprise and to his credit, the fact that he had this very intimate tie with this woman with a Jewish surname did not blunt his objectivity or his willingness to talk about the Jewish problem in all of its aspects and the desirability of separating whites and Jews completely. So I was really impressed by that. And I didn't want to bring up his wife with him. I wanted to see if he'd bring it up with me. And sometime in 2015, really at the first opportunity that he could actually do it, we were on a long train ride together, he brought it up and told me about it. And I felt relieved that he was upfront about this with me. And it turned out that he basically told everybody that he knew and trusted eventually when he got an opportunity to do so, right? The proper time and place. You can't just do it while you're having a conversation over dinner in a crowded room or something. You've got to have the right circumstances. And I believe that any of his friends and confidants that he didn't tell, well, it was simply a matter of time before he did, right? It wasn't because he had a policy of hiding this. He had a policy of sharing this when it was appropriate. And what he told me was that his wife was half Jewish through her father, that he had known her for 8 years at the time, had married her long before he was really red-pilled on the Jewish question, that she had a somewhat weak Jewish identity, wasn't really strongly ethnocentric or attached to that community, although she had natural feelings of affection for the Jewish side of her family, and that she was basically supportive of his views and his work. And I thought, well, this could be a lot worse, right? The fact that he had a half-Jewish wife did not prevent him from being red-pilled and fully open about the Jewish problem and what needs to happen. That, I thought, was very important. And the fact that she was supportive and that they had a happy marriage meant that it wasn't going to be upset, that his work wasn't going to be upset by her, like finding out or blowing up about it someday. And I thought, you know, that's about the best we can hope for. Again, we can't create everything from scratch. But if I were creating Mike Enoch from scratch, of course, I wouldn't have had him marry a half-Jewish woman. But that's not the way life works. I don't get to make other people's lives up from scratch to suit my agenda. And given his situation, he did something really remarkable, and people can accuse him of being a hypocrite, and that's all well and good. I think hypocrisy is a very forgivable sin. I would rather people be hypocrites and pay lip service to the truth, right? La Rochefoucauld said that hypocrisy is vice's tribute to virtue. I would rather people pay tribute to virtue, or in this case, truth, than have integrity, and that integrity meant, in his case, not being fully honest about the Jewish problem, right? I think that it's far more important that we have people who are willing to make a certain sacrifice, a certain personal sacrifice, to speak the truth, than who are more concerned about their authenticity or integrity or being comfy in their situation, and so are going to cut and trim the truth to fit that, to fit who they are. Machiavelli once said that he would sacrifice his immortal soul for his homeland. And that's the attitude that I like. I would sacrifice my immortal soul for my race. And in a way, Mike made a certain kind of sacrifice, a spiritual sacrifice, by preaching certain things that he could not comfortably practice. And maybe he wouldn't fit in with the ethnostate, but I think he would have been willing to make that sacrifice because he thought it was true. And there are many people who are not white at all who believe in our cause. They think it's appalling that white people are being marched off to extinction in this slow and stealthy extermination process that we are enmeshed in, and they want it to stop. There are people that I know who would like to live in multicultural societies who are white. They're white, and if they had a little multicultural city-state, they'd live there, but they still support white nationalism because they think it's appalling that white people are being marched off to extinction. So there are complicated people who still believe in our cause, and the most important thing, though, is that they believe in our cause. I think the message is more important than the messenger, and that's especially the case in a movement where people use pseudonyms a lot, keep their private lives private, because, of course, we're targets, and there are doxers and Antifa who want to shut us down and shut us up or physically harm us. So we have to treat the message as more important than the messenger. And indeed, the messenger might not even exist, right? He might have a completely fake persona. There are a lot of people on the internet who have names on their accounts that are not the names on their driver's licenses, right? And that gives them a certain freedom to create a persona. It might not be real. They might be engaged in a certain amount of disinfo to throw people off their trail. I think that's all legitimate in war. I don't think that Mike was deceiving his friends. He was deceiving his enemies. And to the extent that there were people out there who are well disposed to him that he didn't know and couldn't trust and didn't talk to, of course, they were being deceived by the disinfo as well. But with the people that he knew and trusted and had an opportunity to come clean with, he was very open about it. I do not think that everybody has a right to a piece of you if you're a public figure. It's true of Mike, it's true of me, it's true of you, it's true of Lana. We all have a right to a private life. We all have a right to determine how open and involved we are in this process. And everybody should respect those decisions. And that goes tenfold, a hundredfold for people like us who are actually creating positive content. And I think people should therefore be somewhat understanding of this and not say, oh, he deceived us, I feel betrayed. The fact of the matter is that if you're a public figure, you have to deal with this kind of creepy phenomenon that there are many, many people out there who know of you and you don't know of them. There are many people out there who have essentially imaginary one-way relationships with you, and you have no reciprocal relationship with them. And yet these people get invested in you, and they have this sense of property, right?
Yeah, they have access to you. They need to know what you have going on. Yep.
They think they think they've got a piece of you, and they don't. And I'm only a semi-public figure, right? I'm a faceless person. My name is out there, but my face isn't. That's just because I'm the world's worst person in terms of being unphotogenic. I don't want to see my face out there being mocked and harassed because I look bad in photos. But anyway,
there's not just, that bad, Greg. Come on.
Okay. Well, there are limits, you know. I mean, it's just vanity, I guess, on my part. But,
all right.
You know, I certainly wouldn't want to be in a position to see my family's pictures out there on 8chan, right, being trolled through like Mike's are right now. It's just obscene. I know it's only words and pixels, but it's still obscene. Years ago, this professor of mine said, if somebody walked into my office and picked up the picture that I have of my father or my wife, I think it's a picture of my wife that's sitting on my desk, and spat on it and then wiped it away, well, it's not as if that has been undone. It's only a symbolic gesture, and yet it's not merely a symbolic gesture. It's meaningful, right? It's meaningful even if it's words and pixels. It's meaningful and it's an obscenity, and it bothers me. So I understand why people don't want to be second-guessed and raked over the coals in public. I don't want that, and I know he doesn't want that, but it's happened to him now. So In terms of my basic attitude towards the Daily Show, it's a hugely valuable platform. Like I said, if I was making it up from scratch, I would have probably called it a different thing. And I think even Mike believes that now. I think that it's going to be a tremendously valuable platform on into the future. Mike is not quitting from this. Seventh Son is not quitting from this. There have been a few people who have left the platform, not so much because they're mad at Mike or anything, but simply because they're afraid that they're going to be doxxed next and they want to head for the hills. They want to retrench, rethink things. I don't blame them. That's their right. I wish it wouldn't happen, but that's their right, and we have to respect that. I just want to make them, I want to work on them a little, try and get them to come back, okay?
Yeah.
Because ultimately we can't all run from this. But The Daily Show is going to continue. He's going to continue. Once all the dust is settled, they're going to figure out ways of monetizing it better so they can make a living from this. And that is going to make them far more effective advocates for basically white nationalism. And maybe Mike's going to be like Moses, right? He's going to glimpse the promised land, but he's not going to enter it. There are going to be a lot of people out there who are going to be, you know, mad at him and denigrating him till the sun burns out. But, you know, you can't pay attention to people like that. You simply can't. I'm going to stay with him. He's going to stay with the cause. And that's basically it. So that's why I stand by him. I think the message is more important than the messenger. Yeah, he's somewhat compromised in the sense that he has divided, tangled loyalties. But look, that's the Jewish plan, right? The Jewish plan, if you put it in the most sort of crudely conspiratorial terms, is smash our families up, you know, make divorce easy, make race mixing easy, make people selfish, create these blended families, mix up our genes and our loyalties to the point where we can't even contemplate separating ourselves from this multicultural mess, even though we need to do that to survive as a people. That's their plan. And even though that's their plan, we are finding that people raised in this kind of environment are still being red-pilled. It's harder. It's more painful for them to contemplate separation, but it's still happening. And that's a good story. That's an important thing to learn. We all have a vision of a perfected world. We want ethnostates, so white people will survive in the future. All the different white groups will survive into the future and propagate ourselves. That's what life is all about. That's what gives life a greater meaning than just pursuing selfish pleasure and personal aims. We want that to come about, and we know why we're in this terrible state, and yet we are the products of the society that we want to change. You know, a lot of us have come through every possible stupid position. A lot of us grew up with half brothers or half sisters who are not entirely white, or in families where they have adopted non-whites like we've did. That was designed to confuse us and destroy our race beyond any hope of recall, and it still isn't working. And if we believe that a decadent society is bad, it's only bad because none of us are immune to its consequences. Right? None of us are immune to its corruptions. So what we've got is a situation where everybody basically involved in this movement to improve society is a product of the society we want to overthrow. And it would be very cheap and easy to go around and point fingers at people and say, you're not perfect.
Right.
But that's just not, you know, we don't get to make things up from scratch. People aren't what we would like them to be. They're not our projections. There are lots of people out there who had projections of Mike or fantasies about Mike that are feeling disappointed because their fantasies have been shattered. He's not the person they imagined him to be. It doesn't mean that he was pretending or deceiving. He was being who he is as openly as he can. And of course, now He could be fully who he is, as openly as he wants to be, and he's going to be a much more effective and dangerous opponent of our enemies. So I think that's really the takeaway here. I support the guy. He's always been honest with me. He's done really good work. I'm proud to call him a friend, and I'm going to continue doing that.
You know, one thing I can say here too is that there's a seems to be a kind of a prevailing unhealthy paranoia around the Jewish issue as well. And hear me out now. It seems to lead to people to become tremendously frenetic about kind of, you know, protecting both themselves and others from this kind of the virus, right? That it's kind of, it's contagious in its proximity. Kind of how people felt, I guess, some people felt, just because Lana spoke with Reactionary Jew recently, that show. And although no demands were made of people that he should believe that they should believe the guy, or that somehow something was changed, or that this reversed all the other 1,200 shows or so that we have done. But having said that, you know, obviously this is a serious issue, and that's understandable. It's nothing to joke about. We should be vigilant. We should be, you know, alert about this. But one thing that, to kind of look at from it from a positive point of view, something that Patrick LeBrun mentioned. He said that people call him, you know, like a Mossad agent or something, like after he, it was a show he did with me a couple of months ago, or maybe it's more than that now. And he said he was, to a certain extent, he said he was glad that people did this, because it showed him that those people have declared themselves to be our enemies. They are a serious threat. And he was glad to see that people were so vigilant about being on their toes about this. That they're, you know, they are reacting as soon as, you know, there is this proximity or something like that. And although I think that at the end of the day, if it was seen from an objective point of view, I think that it would be, it would hurt. It would be, what I'm saying is that there's more misunderstandings made because of this issue. That people get so frenetic about it that it's like, I mean, personally, I don't believe this angle that just because there's 0.001% DNA or something that's Jewish, that they're out the window, you know? And no, just to, you know, push back at any accusations, neither me or Lana has any Jewish DNA in the per mil or anything like that. I'm about 90% Scandinavian, about 10% Western European, and Lana is 100% Eastern European. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, I've spoken with Gilad Atzmon, Israel Shamir on the show, and Lana spoken with David Cole before and others. It's just like there's people here that have, you know, interesting ideas to bring to the table, and we've never been afraid of listening to any of these people just because of their genetic makeup. Now, if they're working against your interests or trying to push some BS on you, then yeah, sure, you should be vigilant and point that out, whatever. But if you think that speaking with people is somehow contagious, even if they are ideologically opposed to you, then I don't know what to tell you. I don't think that, you know, the Grima worm tongue thing is actually a real thing. I think if you just subject yourself to that or open up to, you know, being manipulated, then yeah, sure, you might be manipulated. But I don't think there's a metaphysical kind of aspect where people can just kind of voodoo you into doing something that you don't want to do or something like that. There seems to be an unhealthy paranoia around this, which ultimately is detrimental, because what I think it leads to is misunderstandings, exaggerations, and it seems in some situations people are more willing to stab fellow identitarians, fellow pro-white or pro-European people in the back just because they think that they've been, you know, they're contagious, or they got this virus. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like it's so just intensely this paranoia around it, basically, which it shatters relationships and it breaks things apart. When instead there should be a better, just a comprehension skills are not that great when people end up in this mode and all they see is enemies everywhere. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, there is a kind of fear of contagion that is going on here. And it's a kind of superstitious fear. And some of it is linked to a sense of blood contagion. And I'm not talking about genetics. Genetics is a very new thing. I'm talking about old ideas like the Old Testament prescription on adultery and things like that, or mixing with other tribes, right? There's a superstitious, pre-scientific sense of blood contagion and pollution. And it's been given a kind of scientific veneer with genetics. But when you actually talk to some people about it, you realize it's just a superstitious notion of blood contagion and purity. So, for instance, there are people who think that the reason that what makes Jews obnoxious and destructive is their genes, as if the 613 commandments in the Torah are somehow inscribed in their DNA, as if the Jewish live and let die ethos is inscribed in their DNA. There is clearly a genetic component to Jewishness, and I think the chief genetic component to it is high ethnocentrism, which is something that you find in all Near Eastern peoples. They are far more ethnocentric than Europeans. It's just true, and it's genetic, it's inborn, and that's not speculation. That's simply fact, that's scientific fact. Now, on the foundation of that high ethnocentrism, they have layered on a culture and an ideology that makes them incredibly misanthropic and hostile to other peoples. But that ideology isn't created by their genes. It's simply layered on top, and it's a cultural rather than a genetic phenomenon, which means that you can transplant the Jewish mind into Gentiles, and they will act really Jewy. That's certainly true with the Puritans and other sort of Judaizing, Old Testament LARPing Christian sects. You know, they don't get fully as obnoxious as Jews, but they really get close to being as obnoxious and misanthropic and live and let die as Jews do. And you can have people who are genetically very similar to Jews in their levels of ethnocentrism, like Armenians, for instance, or Maronite Christians, yet they don't have the Jewish ideology, and therefore they're not as hostile to outsiders as Jews are. So it's a combination of genetics and culture, but the main content of what makes Jews inimical to other civilizations is really their religion and culture, which is deeply misanthropic and makes them basically enemies of mankind. They choose the rest of mankind as their enemies, and that makes them very problematic people. Now, ethnocentrism, like most traits, is distributed on bell curves, and there are always going to be Jews who are weakly ethnocentric. And when you get half and quarter Jews, again, that can be really very weak. And in the past, weakly ethnocentric Jews have simply drifted away from their community, and they get absorbed by other communities. And they've been absorbed for thousands of years by Europeans. One of the ways that they did it was through baptism. And they didn't just do it because they thought it was a way of social mobility and they were still secretly practicing Judaism, although that happened. Yeah, it wasn't necessarily forced baptism, right? Sometimes they would just do it because they looked around at their Jewish relatives and they said, fuck this, I don't want to be at war with the rest of humanity. And so they leave the community. And so when there are Jews who are like that, I just don't think of them as threats. And I think it's just a superstitious notion of blood contagion that is wrapped up in pseudoscientific talk about genetics that is driving this. And I think we have to take a step back and analyze this. Now, does that mean that since there are a few good Jews, that we don't need to separate ourselves from Jews as a block? No, that doesn't imply that at all. There are good Jews. There just aren't enough, right? There are just not enough good Jews. And that means that we can't really live with them. We can't just make them like a denomination of our society or an ethnic subgroup. They really are a distinct and overall very hostile community, and we should separate from them. And with half Jews and quarter Jews and things like that, well, that's a problem. those are limit cases. We're going to have to figure out how to do that, how to deal with that. But that's something we can do down the road. And in the meantime, we've got situations like Mike Enoch, and I just think we have to judge the man by his deeds, not by his marriage. And in terms of what he has actually done and what he's actually said, it's very clear that the fact that he's been married to a half-Jewish woman has not led him to pull his punches at all and talking about the Jewish question. And that's really the best we can expect.
And I guess people get, this is what I'm talking about, there's almost like the treatment sometimes is that there's a metaphysical component to this that you just can't, you know, kind of work around. And again, I'm not saying that any of the fear and vigilance that people have about it isn't well-founded. I mean, considering everything that's going on, what I'm saying is that I just think it's detrimental that rumors to spread and people end up believing anything they read online just because someone said so without proving it, and people run with it because they're more you know, prone to believing stuff, and they get paranoid instead of actually listen to what the person say or talking about the facts.
Right. And there is a tendency I've noticed when these things get kind of paranoid, right? When the little hamster cages get all excited and you hear all this squeaking and scurrying around in the internet, people just make shit up. There are all these lies that are just created out of whole cloth and circulated around these things. And that's when I realized that something's really wrong here.
Should we really not assume that there wouldn't be antagonizers to increase the rift? The JIDFs of the world are in there and just like continuing you know, have their avatars and people just continuing to launch, you know, accusations and baseless, you know, half-truths, untruths, and lies, and everything else, just to stir the pot among people.
That's true, and that's definitely part of it. But in my personal experience, I've had interactions with people that I know are not JIDF. They are bona fide white nationalists, but when they have a falling out with somebody, they just start telling lies. when their paranoia gets triggered, they start making stuff up. They can't stop it in some ways. They start seeing patterns, and they're just so sure that it's there. And what paranoia is a kind of false pattern recognition where the underlying affect and motivation that's driving it is fear and hate, right? You can have false pattern recognition problems where your underlying emotion is ebullience and love, and you think everybody's one and God is speaking through you and stuff like that. I mean, that's kind of what happens when people get manic. But then there are people who are primarily motivated by sort of hate and fear, and they have no ability to control their mind's pattern recognition processes, and they're constantly coming up with false patterns, or they're seeing things that aren't there. And sometimes they'll just make up stuff that fits in with the theory to try and float it, right? It sounds good. And I know people who are not JIDF agents. They're not enemy agents. They're just slightly paranoid and crazy people in our milieu who will do this kind of stuff. So that is an actual problem.
Yeah, you know, I talked about it from the point of view of mental hygiene, that I think if you just always move in these environments, mentally speaking, that can kind of create a kind of unhealthy, a very unhealthy mind as well, that you need different aspects in your life, health-wise, to stay sane. Yes, the world is in shambles. Yes, it's being destroyed. Yes, we have people that are actively doing these things to undermine us and our interests and all these things. So it's not like that you can throw it out. It's what you said with pattern recognition. Sometimes the situation is somewhere in between. Sometimes there are things that really are true when you connected two dots, but maybe the third one wasn't there, and that's the exaggeration you made or you went to it. And I just, again, I'm not trying to downplay any of this that's going on. I'm not really talking about that directly. I'm just talking about this environment that when people just don't do anything else in their life than just obsess about these things all the time, I think that creates an unhealthy environment. And for us to be a well-rounded individual that can deal with this in a sane way and in the best way possible, we just, people just need to take breaks from this stuff. I've seen it drive people crazy, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. When I say that, look, there are paranoid and conspiratorial anti-Semites, that does not mean that Jews aren't out to get us and that they're not working together to do it. But there are people who will take those basic truths, which are very, very important, and they will muck them up with fictions and simplistic notions. And they'll just be sure that they see, ah, they're doing it to us again, or this is obvious, or this is JIDF, or this is whatever, and it's not. They put forward overly simplified accounts of things, and they will confabulate things from a few bits of quote-unquote evidence, a few facts that aren't often true. And the reason why it's a problem is that there is so much truth here that we can't afford to muck it up with half-truths and kooky stuff. So the reason why I get worried about this is that there's so much truth here, it cannot be adulterated with craziness. We have to keep it pure so that we can persuade people of it, because it's very, very important that we persuade people that there really are problems. There really is white genocide. It's not just some ghastly cosmic accident. There really is white genocide. It is intentional. And Jews are at the core of this. And this is such an important truth that we can't muck it up with crazy and extraneous stuff. So we've got to be careful.
Yeah, and the measure, the way we come to the truth is not always a straight and a narrow road either. You know, you try different theories out, you test them, you corroborate, you do end up believing things until you find a piece of information that contradicted it, or, you know, this is just how it goes. It's not up. This is the why it also is good in one way, but it's also why it's difficult, that there isn't just one person that can just deliver it and say, here's the truth, here it is. You know, it is dynamic until we have all the information that we need to formulate our opinions about what the world is. And so it is a difficult process. It is a lot of back and forth. And I think the point, though, to remember, I think, is that I don't know anybody who was just like born like ready on the page, 100%, good to go, never any mistakes, never anything done. And there, those people doesn't exist. It's almost like a belief in that some kind of immaculate, godly creature or something like that. And everyone makes screw-ups, some more than others and some more grave than others. And again, I understand the anger maybe around all this, that I saw some people, they feel that this was, you know, with TRS or whatever, that was all a ploy to get people's, donations or details or addresses or when they were meeting up and stuff like that. And I saw people just run with it. I was like, whoa, hang on, here now. You know, it's like, where is this coming from? We can't, you know, we can't confirm this. And people are just running with it immediately. And it's a shame to see that, because I think, as you say, it's like all of a sudden, all the other work that has been done is just thrown out the window instantly. It's like what we've done with this show. It's like 10 years in the making, over 1,200 shows, and then we do one show, and they're just like stab you in the back and just like run in the opposite direction immediately because it was one little thing they didn't agree with. And it's just too reactionary. It's unhealthy, you know?
Yeah. History does not always come down to one little thing. The world is not that simple. And I've used this phrase, starting from scratch. If we started everything from scratch, we would not make mistakes. If we could rewrite our lives, we would know the truth when we were born. But that's not the way things happen. We don't get to start from scratch. We don't get to start with a clean slate. We start with ignorance. And we grope our way around until we find the truth. And that means that we go through a long process of making mistakes. And the key is not to avoid mistakes, because that's impossible. What's important is, once you've made a mistake, to have the ability to correct it.
Sure.
Yep. And I I said this in my piece about Mike. It's something I quoted from a piece about Donald Trump. It was after the whole quote-unquote Pussygate scandal. I said, what makes a man great? A great man is not necessarily a good man. He's not necessarily a man who makes no mistakes. He's not necessarily a man who's got no flaws. He's not a man who has never faced adversity. What makes a man great is that he overcomes his mistakes. He rises above his flaws. He triumphs over adversity and so forth. And I think that what's going on with Mike and with TRS is they've come to a crossroads and they can choose. This doxing thing can destroy them if they let it, or they can surmount it and become greater because of it. Because again, great people are not people who don't have flaws. They're the ones who overcome their flaws, transcend them, make them part of a greater narrative, make them serve a greater good. And the truth about Mike's life is far more interesting and inspiring than the fantasies that a lot of people have had about it. And eventually he's going to tell that whole story. He's going to be telling it in an interview with Musonius Rufus. I'm going to do an interview with him as well. He's going to tell the whole story. It's an impressive story. When I did my first interview with Nathan D'Amigo, before we actually started recording, I said, Nathan, you were in jail. You were put in prison. And I found out about this on the web. Other people in the movement know about it. Other people in the movement who wish you ill are going to use it against you. So I'd like to talk about this in the interview. And he sort of hemmed and hawed about it, and we talked it over a little bit. And he said, yeah, let's do it. Let's go for it. And so I asked him about it. And it was really one of those moments where you can go one way and be a bourgeois person, you know, who's risk averse and wants to run away from problems, or you can be an Ubermensch. You can overcome these things. And he did the Ubermensch thing. He rose above it. Again, all of us are products of the society that we despise and want to replace with something better. Nathan, he's typical. He's really typical of his generation. A lot of bad things have happened in his life, and he's overcome it and made it into a really inspiring story. And that's true with Mike as well, and he's going to tell that story in the coming days and weeks. So that's what we have to take away from this. What's happened with TRS is certain facts have come to light that shatter a lot of people's fantasies and illusions, but the truth is actually more inspiring, and they're going to grapple with this crisis and surmount it, and they're going to come out embiggened, to use a perfectly cromulent word. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I haven't looked into all of this, and I don't know, you know, about Mike's personal life or anything like that. So yeah, we will have to hear him out and hear what he has to say and see if he can settle some of the accusations or not. And that's how it goes. That's how the cookie crumbles. And again, it's just back to this kind of point that we started on there, Greg, that, you know, things happen in life. You run in a certain direction and then all of a sudden things change, you know, completely. And that's just also the nature of being in this kind of, environment that we are in, that we create a lot of enemies and hostile people out there, and sometimes the most hostile are those that are within this line of thinking, this ideological framework that we're in, more so than leftists, bizarrely enough. That's what we have to deal with. I mean, there's people who are they're utterly convinced that Lana is Jewish, or that we are some kind of, you know, outlet to fool people. It doesn't matter. You just, whatever you say, these people are convinced, and it's just nothing you can do to like try to salvage them with all the facts, with all the, truth that you pour at them. It doesn't matter, you know?
Right. Yeah. You just have to learn the signs. And when you see those signs, you just sort of walk on by. Don't get caught in that briar patch.
No, exactly. That's just it. Does it matter at the end? This is the other thing to it as well. If you'd get stuck just like defending yourself all the time against the most nonsensical accusations flying around, you'd get nothing else done. You wouldn't be able to produce anything. You wouldn't be able to mass communicate with people. You'd sit and gibber with someone who's just probably there to steal all your time from you anyway on Twitter or something, you know?
Oh, exactly. There's a lot of truth to that.
Obviously, a lot more could be said and all that stuff, but we just have to see where it goes. Again, as I said, I haven't taken the time to dive into all of this. So I'm just going to hear Mike out and see what he has to say about it. So it is what it is, you know, and we'll see where it goes from here. But yeah, what do you say, Greg? Anything else you want to add before we wrap up here for this time?
I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for having me on. I've missed you guys. It's been a while. And I just encourage everybody to come to countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com and check out what we're doing. We've been growing tremendously like the rest of the movement. We have a lot of good material. And if you want to read more about the Mike Enoch story, the top thing at Countercurrents right now is why I stand with Mike Enoch, why I support Mike Enoch. So thank you, Henrik. Thank you, Lana. Thank everybody at Red Ice for having me on.
Awesome. Thanks, Greg, the editor of Countercurrents. Check out the website. Check out their books as well. We have a link, of course, in the description for the show. We'll talk soon again, Greg. Take care.
Take care.